Hello and welcome to EPR with your favorite environmental enthusiasts, Nick and Laura. On today's episode, Laura and I discuss Halloween. We also sit down with retired Rear Admiral Tim Gallaudet. He is the CEO of Ocean STL Consulting. We talk to him about the military, oceanography, and the blue economy. And finally, horned lizards will shoot tears of blood out of their eyes when threatened. And I get that it can be the difference between life and death for them, but it still feels like an overreaction. Any other fluid would have been fine, I think. Just spit, you know, that's what llamas do. So
that's perfect for Halloween.
Yeah.
That'd be a really sick costume, right? Like, I'm a horned lizard.
Yeah, gotcha. Yes. It totally would be. Oh my gosh, that's brilliant. So, yes, if I see you dressed like a horned lizard, I will duck.
Just don't threaten them.
Right, yeah. Oh, gosh. And with that, hit that music.
All right, today we're bringing back the shout outs and we are going to celebrate Ron Deverman. He was recently appointed to the Transformative Leadership Advisory Council for George Washington University School of Business in Washington, D.C. Congrats, Ron. We appreciate you on our leadership committee here with NAEP.
Yeah.
And upcoming for NAEP, the registration is open for the October 27th webinar, Environmental Rulemaking, featuring panelist Janie Hine with the Council on Environmental Quality, Michael Drummond with the U.S. Department of Transportation, and our own podcast alum, Ted Bowling, with Perkins & Coie, LLP. It's going to be extremely insightful, especially in light of the Phase 1 updates from CEQ on NEPA regulations. Sign up at www.naep.org. Nick and I love doing the show, and if you love it too and would like us to keep doing it, we need your help. We can't do this program without our awesome sponsors, so please be sure to head on over to environmentalprofessionalsradio.com and check out the sponsor form for details. Now let's get to our segment.
Awesome. Okay, so you want to talk Halloween? Is that what you want to talk about?
Yeah, sure.
You want to do it now? Yeah, Halloween's coming up. We're allowed to do Halloween this year, I think. So
you think? Yeah.
I think. I'm not sure.
I think honestly. We are.
I think we are too. Yeah. So
I think people are doing it whether they're allowed to or not.
Yeah, you're probably right. But I don't know. Like you have you have to have good memories of Halloween, right? It's like the best holiday for kids. It is.
Yeah.
I actually got the flu on Halloween one year.
Like,
worst day of my childhood. I mean, like it was 103, so I had no chance, none of going out, right? And so my brother and I, as I was going to be a baseball player, I had my hat, my uniform, everything all set up. And I'm like, I'm fine. You know, my mom's like, no, you and I are staying home. I love you, but I'm a nurse. Yeah. So they go, my brother and my dad go out. And he comes back and he's so gloating. He's like, I got all this candy. You didn't get me. And my dad, to his infinite credit, he just lets my brother go for like 5 minutes. And right as he's about to wrap up, my dad puts his hand right in the middle of the candy and shoves it off to one side. He goes, that's Nick's. Nice. That's yours. And the look on his face is still like one of my favorite memories.
That's great.
You know, he's like, oh. I never for once thought this could happen. So that was a good one. That was a good one from my dad.
I love that. I don't know. I think I know a lot of people who just love Halloween. And I think it's becoming more of the more popular one.
Yeah. And I love that it starts in August now. Like that's when you start seeing like it's almost fall. Let's celebrate Halloween. I'm like, fall's another month and a half away. What are we doing? But
well, it's cool being up here in Syracuse where you can have a jack-o'-lantern or a pumpkin out on your porch for months and it stays
still fine.
A pumpkin or a jack-o'-lantern. In Florida, after 2 weeks, it becomes a ball of mush that stinks sitting on your porch.
It's about the same here. That's so funny. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, like even fall starts earlier for you up there too. And like, we still have all the leaves on our trees, for example, none of them had changed colors. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah. It's still humid here, actually, which really frustrates me.
It's been exceptionally warm here.
Yeah.
And still is, but the leaves are changing.
Yeah.
And it's apple picking season, which is cool.
Right. That's what I'm telling you. Fall is the best season for all kinds of reasons. But yeah, I love the change in leaves. I love the, you know.
Are you a PSL person?
I knew you were going to ask. I am not. I am not, though. But I'm not a sweets person either. Like, I don't like sweet things okay. nearly as much as I like. I'm so sorry for offending you. No, I'm a salty person. So if you give me like a bag of like honey barbecue chips, I literally won't chew. I'll just inhale. And yeah, so those are great. But like, I don't do the PSLs. I can appreciate it. It smells nice, you know, but it's not my thing. I love pumpkin pie, though. That's like my thing. That was like my version of cake. My birthday is also like right before Thanksgiving every year. So
Every year it is?
Yeah, every year. If you can believe it, it's at the same time.
Yeah, wow.
It's stunning, I know.
I'll have to try to remember that.
Yeah, if you could. Yeah, actually, I think everyone's birthday is at the same time every year. You know, well, you know what I mean. I don't mean literally. We all have one birthday. That'd be ridiculous. But yeah, so, I'm a smart person. I swear. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any plans for Halloween?
No, I don't. I want to say that I have a friend of mine who is throwing a house party, so I may show up as a skeleton.
Classic.
Right. Yeah. Which is, you know, I just mean that cause I'm very skinny. I'm not going to wear a costume. I'm just no. So I may do that. That's on my list of things to do for Halloween, but, yeah, don't have kids and I'm not single. So I feel like, you know, those are the prerequisites for Halloween.
Right.
I don't know. Are you doing anything crazy? Or?
Also have an invite to a party. Don't know that I'm actually going to show up yet.
So we're both boring is what yeah, we're saying. We're kind awesome. Of like... Yeah, cool.
I do like to be home and hand out candy. I like to do that part.
Yeah.
Yeah, like and hide. I live in a neighborhood where lots of kids come. So
yeah.
It's pretty cool.
That's
and
awesome.
Then I blast Thriller through the window and then, like over and on repeat right, all right. night.
Gosh.
And my boyfriend likes to set up a projector and a sheet and play like the old Disney scary videos like, through the window, so we make a little
old Disney scary movies. What are you talking about?
I don't know what they're called. There's like the dancing skeletons and
there's little
and
shorts.
I think there's a little Mickey Mouse scary episode or something. I don't know. I'll have to send you some videos.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm working the homebody angle there.
I know. But you know what, though? I mean, maybe we can. This is the angle for this. Saying yes is a good thing. It's a good thing, generally speaking. We should both go to these parties. Like, you know, this is what the stuff we're telling people.
Yeah, let's go and report back.
Stuff we're telling people to do, you know, your careers, you know, is to say yes when given an opportunity because you just never know, right? It's like it happens all the time. I don't want to go out. And then you go out and you have a great time.
Right.
And it's the same thing in careers, the same thing. You know, it's like, oh, I don't know if I want to go to Alabama for 3 months, but. You know, being away from family and all that, but it ended up being a great career thing for me. And I'm glad I did. And despite how difficult it was. So I don't know. Maybe we should follow our own advice.
Good job tying that into career advice.
Right.
So I'll just say, Nick, PSA,
mm-hmm.
drink and drive responsibly.
Of course.
Yes, grab absolutely. That Uber home if you need to. Mm-hmm. And yeah, let's do it. I'll go if you go.
All right. Done. We'll report back on our misadventures. There we go.
And I need to have at least one photo of this skeleton costume.
Okay. Dang, she's on to me. All right. I'm not doing the full makeup thing. I'm not doing it. But I've got a mask I can put on. So.
Yeah. All right, everyone. Have a fun, safe Halloween and do it responsibly. Let's get to our interview.
All right. Welcome back to EPR. Today we have Rear Admiral Tim Gallaudet, who is the CEO of Ocean STL Consulting, the host of the American Blue Economy podcast, and a Federal Senior Executive Service coach and mentor with the Mason Harriman Group. And we're really excited to have you on the show, Tim. Thank you.
Hey, Nick. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you were a Rear Admiral with the Navy, which is, you know, a two-star admiral, and I want to know what inspired you to join the military? How were you able to become a Rear Admiral? And how has that experience shaped where you are today?
Well, yeah, it's relevant to this program because I fell in love with the ocean growing up in Southern California, hitting the beach, swimming, surfing. And I just knew from an early age, I wanted to study it and work on it and do things to protect it. So that was my kind of pull. And it led me to the Navy because the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland has a great undergraduate oceanography program. And there weren't that many back in 1985 programs like that around the country. And, you know, my dad had served in the Navy. And so I kind of combined my belief and ethic of service with passion for the oceans. And I went there and I became an oceanography officer after I graduated and served for 32 years and really just loved every bit of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really, you completed your military career as the oceanographer of the Navy. So you're on the staff of Chief of Naval Operations, right? So you say you were by the beach and that's kind of what drew you to oceanography. But how did you turn that interest into a very successful career?
Well, sure. The Navy has a great need to conduct ocean science and then apply it, as well as environmental science in general, for example, meteorology. And so that's what I did in the Navy. I worked in various jobs. I was either mapping the seafloor in the Arabian Gulf, or I did weather forecasting in the Mediterranean and on several ships, notably during the Iraq War and the Afghanistan campaign. And I also work with Navy SEALs who use weather and ocean information like nobody else, at high precision wave. And so I worked kind of through the ranks. And yeah, my last job in the Pentagon was the head oceanographer of the Navy. And that was kind of where I did a lot of policy and budget type kind of actions, if you will. That's sort of what you do in the Pentagon. And so I kind of been at all levels. You know, it's been great.
Yeah. So when you're like a senior oceanographer, when you're, you know, the lead there, is what's your number one priority for supporting the fleet? Now you say policy, but what specifically are you doing?
Well, there were a couple of things. You know, one of the priorities I had was advancing technologies to help us do our job better. So, I mean, the priority is keeping the fleet safe and effective because the weather can cause mission kills all the time. And so just advancing our ability to not only know what's happening, that's through observations in the oceans, the atmosphere, even in space, but also to improve the predictability and our modeling. So weather and ocean modeling, and you hear a lot about that now with respect to climate. A big mission of the Navy, and I oversaw all the people doing that. And using advanced technologies was one of my priorities. So autonomous systems, drones, both aerial, surface, and undersea is something I advanced. And that's helping us know the ocean really now better than we ever have.
So how has that changed? I mean, I imagine technology's gotten better, so we've gotten better. But is there anything specific that you used to do that you no longer have to that because of that advancement?
Well, yeah, let me give you an example. So one of my jobs early on after I got my first degree at Scripps, a master's degree, was I was a hydrographic survey officer on a ship in the Arabian Gulf. It was right after the first Gulf War, and our charts of the region were really poor. And so I was surveying the area, both mapping sonar and updating the charts. Well, we had a vessel with about four, five sailors on it, a small boat, maybe actually four of them, and we towed a side scan sonar to look for wrecks and hazards to navigation. Nowadays, and I'm actually working for a company called IxBlue that automates that entire capability, the unmanned surface vehicle that's called a Drix, and it can tow a side scan sonar. Their little vehicle is called a Flipix, and it's like totally automated. And that is the way of the future. You look at what, you know, Amazon's doing for delivery. What I did previously in the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration after I left the Navy, and you're just seeing autonomous technology and artificial intelligence just proliferate in the areas that environmental professionals are working in. And it's actually just creating great opportunity, and our ability to understand and manage the environment is really at a level we've never seen before.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's really cool. I love to hear that.
It's super cool. Okay, so that leads perfectly into the follow-up question to that is, what do you see as the Navy's biggest challenge in regard to climate change impact on national security?
Yeah, Laura. Well, first off, interestingly, another job I had in the Navy as the oceanographer of the Navy, I was also the director of their task force, climate change, and I established it under my boss, Admiral Dave Titley. I was his deputy director, and we stood it up in 2009. And then I ended up taking over that job and being the director of it when I became the oceanographer of the Navy. And a lot of our priorities were the same as they are today. And that was ensuring our installations are ready and can withstand things like sea level rise and increased warming and increasingly intense storms, as well as operations, making sure we can stay operationally ready. And severe storms can affect training and certainly the conduct of any type of activity, whether it be strike missions or humanitarian assistance, which we're seeing, you know, we conducted all over the globe. And so being weather and climate ready, it was a priority then, and we were established for that reason. And it remains today. And you might not have seen that the Department of Defense and all the agencies under the Biden administration did release climate adaptation plans for the reasons like I just described.
Oh, that's all fascinating. You've mentioned so many different specialties and technologies and different lines of science that someone could get into. So if someone is just starting their career and is interested in getting into marine science or oceanography, like what kind of advice do you have for them just starting out?
That's a great question. And I love that you asked this on most of your episodes. Well, really, the one piece of advice I'd simply put is do what you love. You know, if you love policy, go that route. If you love doing the science, do that. And if depending on what it is the ocean. And what is it in the ocean? Is it fish or coral? It's just find what you really love to do. And then it won't be work. You know, I think That's the best advice I can give anybody.
Right. I see Nick smiling. So
I was just agreeing. I was just very happy to agree. And just, you know, you actually sparked me a little bit on question. You talk about all the stuff the Navy does. And I think what you said may surprise a lot of people listening because they're like, wait, there's all kinds of science. There's different things. And even like the Navy even does studies on marine mammals as well. So I don't know if I want to give you another opportunity, if there's anything else from a science perspective that the Navy does that's worth telling our listeners.
Well, sure. You know, being in this show, I think they'd be most interested to know that the Navy takes very seriously their responsibility to protect the environment. And of course, there's laws they have to follow, like the National Environmental Policy Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, the Endangered Species Act. And the Navy does that very seriously. And I'm working with a really terrific company that also works with NOAA, my other organization I've been a part of. And they're called Linker Technologies. And they're real leaders in doing things like environmental impact assessments. And we are working to potentially do some of that work for the Navy and, you know, environmental studies out in the Pacific region. And so, yeah, the Navy is actually a very serious environmental steward, but not by law, but also by principle, because they need to maintain the public trust. And so all that pristine coral reef and habitat we have on Guam and Hawaii, that the Navy is working to protect and preserve those really great places that happens to reside or lie in some of their installations.
Yeah,
that's great. Love to hear that. All right. So how long were you in the Navy?
32 years. I count my time at the Naval Academy because I had an identity card and I was subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So
there you go.
That counts.
Yes, it does.
You have a very youthful aura. I would not have. That's a, you know, yeah, when you see retired funny. On there, you're like, what? How?
Some people, they expect me to be a little more silver haired. But
right. Yeah.
I have three daughters and they keep me young.
There we go. Great.
That's good. Sometimes you hear the opposite.
Well, no, really, speaking of, they're the next generation, and I'm really excited that my wife, who also graduated from Scripps Institution of Oceanography with a graduate degree in oceanography like me, we both, you know, really want to impart on our girls a love for the oceans and environment, and they've taken it on. They all scuba dive and snorkel, and we were just recently in the Caribbean, and we did a great dive with Caribbean reef sharks right there. It was really fun.
So nice. Awesome.
So 32 years, you must have done a lot of traveling, and I'm guessing you still do a lot of traveling. Maybe not the last year, but.
Well, actually, I'm just picking that back up. I did a lot of travel. I've been around the world, joined the Navy, see the world. And then when I worked with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for 4 years after the Navy, I traveled a lot there too, much in the Pacific, to Europe, really just promoting with the United States as a preferred partner in environmental programs. And I think that's really important today as the globe faces so many challenges. I prefer not to use the word crisis. It turns a lot of people off, but, you know, we are seeing threats to habitat all around the world with warming. But these are solutions that collectively we can get after and solve.
Awesome. And then we always like to find out so we can daydream about our next trips. So what is your, do you have a favorite spot or a favorite dive that you've done?
Well, shoot, I have many, but ultimately when I was working as the deputy administrator at NOAA, I had a side job called, I was the chair of the U.S. Coral Reef Task Force.
Ooh.
Which is, does that sound cool or what?
It does. It totally does.
It was great. And for that job, I went to the Republic of Palau for a meeting of that task force because the U.S., all the U.S. states are members of the task force that have coral reef like Florida and Puerto Rico and Guam and the territories. And as well as the compact states, they call them of Palau, Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands. They're members of it too, key partners of ours. And so we're in Palau, we're having our meeting, we identified a really important need, and that was to not allow the spread of this tissue or this coral disease in Florida called stony coral tissue loss disease to spread to the Pacific. So an action item from that was to take, and we developed a strategy at NOAA and that we're acting on now to prevent the spread of that disease and respond to it. But ultimately, in that meeting, we had a chance to go dive at their National Marine Sanctuary And I did dive there a few times. And that is like it's like the redwood forest of corals there. Really? Just magnificent. Some centuries old structures and just the beauty. And yes, so that experience in Palau caused me to reach out to that country and work with our sanctuary in American Samoa and have them sign an agreement to work together on coral conservation and restoration. And it's really a good and important agreement.
Yeah. Wow. That's really great. And you mentioned NOAA a couple of times. So you were the deputy administrator for NOAA. And when you're at that level, it seems like there's an overwhelming number of responsibilities. So how do you manage all of that? I mean, what else were you doing with them beyond what you just mentioned?
Well, sure. NOAA is a big agency. I actually was the acting administrator for a year and a half, and my permanent job was the deputy. And it's a 20,000 person organization, about 12,000 federal and 8,000 contractors. They have a global footprint. They have a fleet of 16 ships, 9 aircraft, some of which are famed Hurricane Hunter aircraft that fly through hurricane, 400 boats, about 400 technical divers, I mean, very good technical divers, and just thousands of scientists, many with PhDs, and, oh, shoot, not to mention 18 weather satellites and 8 supercomputers. So this is really America's environmental agency. And the EPA is a regulatory agency, but the Environmental Science Agency that just monitors our climate, our weather, our fisheries, our oceans is NOAA. And I loved it. I love working there. There were a good number of responsibilities, but really, like I told you with coral reefs, every one of them I just loved. I mean, yeah. It was just really great to oversee it. For example, fishery science management, the weather satellite program is incredible. These are just amazing pieces of technology that are monitoring hurricanes and saving lives. I could talk multiple episodes all along about how great that agency is.
Yeah, but I mean, it's really interesting stuff, though, and I think it's really helpful for people to learn. Like you say, that's what, you know, multiple avenues and multiple areas of expertise. So if we just maybe talk about weather for a minute. And so NOAA, you say the NOAA that works with hurricanes, how do they do that? What are they actually studying?
Well, it's a great question, Nick. So the NOAA has under it the National Weather Service. And this is America's weather forecasting agency. And there are offices all around the country with forecasters doing what I did in the Navy. I did this on 2 ships. You know, up 24 hours at 7, if you will, 365, providing life-saving warnings and forecasts and all types of weather, blizzards, wildfires, hurricanes. And there's some special centers that are focused solely on certain types of weather, like the National Hurricane Center, which issues those famous cones of uncertainty and track predictions. Right, right. That's it. They're out there. Yeah. They're a fantastic organization. And again, they save lives through these forecasts. And they all rely on some high-powered numerical models run on supercomputers. And one of the interesting things about all this work that we were doing, like that weather forecasting, is how much we've been increasing our partnership with the private sector. Because now commercial weather companies and ocean and weather tech companies that provide the observations, they've been really advancing the state of the art in the technology field. And for example, I also work with another company called Tomorrow.io, and they basically provide these high precision forecasts, and their customers include companies like Ford and Uber and JetBlue, who need just like to the minute, to the 10 meter square grid you're on, what the weather's going to be. You know, you think about airline operations, how dependent they are, again, timing the flights. And so that company is really terrific. And you're seeing them work now more with NOAA's National Weather Service and the Air Force. They just got a contract with the Air Force, $20 million. So this is an interesting sort of development in terms of modern environmental professional work, is that the private sector has really expanded its positive impact. And I think that's a new dynamic in addition to the technology that we talked about.
Yeah. Oh,
and that's 100%. Great to hear.
Yeah. And that's like, so when you don't have turbulence on a flight, that's where it's coming from.
That's really right. Cool. Exactly. Yeah. Routing the planes. Exactly, Nick.
That's awesome.
It is. And you have mentioned several companies and organizations that you work with. There's another one called the Explorers Club that you are a fellow of. Just wondering, what do they do and what's your involvement with them?
Oh, that's nice of you to ask, Laura. Yeah, they're neat, of course, because their membership includes people who have climbed Mount Everest and done all these amazing expeditions. They like to focus on science. So when they sponsor expeditions, they really want to ensure they're not for like someone's self-glorification, but more to learn and spread knowledge. So they have a really good purpose and mission. And I joined them because of my background and experience sailing around the world. And in particular, when I was with NOAA, one of the programs I was a champion of, and we were able to achieve some really significant growth in, is their ocean exploration program. So think about this. The oceans, only about 5 to 10% of the volume of the oceans have been explored.
Yeah.
And think about that. We're putting billion-dollar platforms into space, but we still don't even know our own ocean. And about the seafloor, we haven't even mapped 50% of the seafloor. So we took it on. It was one of my top priorities to develop a program they now call the National Ocean Mapping and Exploration and Characterization Program. It's got a strategy, a plan, a council, and it's going to be established in law with an act that's being worked on in the U.S. Congress. But it's a formal program that we were able to get the White House to support. And that was really, I think, and it's moving forward, and they're advancing it still. So it was able to go through two administrations with bipartisan support, which was great. And it's just about knowing our oceans. You know, there's so much to learn. Think about it. There's all this wind energy that's being developed. Well, we can't do it unless we map the seafloor, understand, making sure it doesn't interfere with any critical fisheries habitat. There's marine minerals that are really important now because we're so dependent upon them. Our cell phones and that kind of battery technology are all dependent upon that. And the sea is a potential source. We need to map and explore it. And then there's just the neat thing about the science. We discovered 25 new species last year, new animals unknown to the world in the ocean. So, I mean, think how exciting that is. One of them was a great, no kidding, a new type of killer whale in Antarctica. Think about that.
Yeah. I'm a super nerd, so I totally read about that. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Great.
Love the program. They're still doing it. And so that brought me into contact with several exploring organizations, and that therefore led me to the Explorers Club. One of them I thought was really interesting. He is a gentleman named Victor Vescovo, who is a Navy commander and also a private equity investor. He has performed the Explorers Club Grand Challenge. He has climbed all the seven highest peaks on the continents, and he skied to the North Pole and the South Pole.
Yeah.
So, and as if that this wasn't enough, he got it into himself that he was going to go build a submersible, a human-occupied submersible, and dive to the five deepest points in all the oceans of the world. And no one had done it. So he ended up working with a company, Triton Submersibles, to build this never before. Well, it's happened twice before, diving to the deepest part of the planet, but not repeated. And he ended up building this great sub called the Limiting Factor. And he's got a ship called the Pressure Drop. And his ship was a former NOAA ship. And basically, he invested $50 million, 25 to build the submersible and outfit the ship, and 25 to take 25 extra to take it all around the world. And he dove the Marianas Trench, the deepest point, over 35,000 feet at repeated times. He's taken several scientists out to that too. And then the four others all around the world. And what was great about this, and so he is a legend in the Explorers Club. And that's kind of what brought me to them, is my friendship with him. His name is Victor Vescovo. His company is Caladan Oceanic. And what was great is that NOAA partnered with him, because we didn't have this capability. The government would never be able to invest in something like that. Mm-hmm. But we kind of piggybacked off what he did and got his mapping data, and were able to use it because it was the most precise map of the deepest point of the ocean that had ever been made. And we put our hydrophones down there that were helped allow us to calibrate and through some math and backwards engineering, determined to that precision, that depth. So it was a great partnership. And those partnerships are something that led me to join that club. And a long answer to your question, Laura.
That is amazing.
It really is. I asked. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
If you Google five deeps, and there's a book about it called Exploration Deep Ocean by Josh Young, and there's a series on the Discovery Channel about it, and you'll see it. And it's just fantastic. And people do glamorize space travel, but boy, I tell you, that was, for me as an ocean person, that was really the depth of sort of achievement.
Yeah. Pun intended, right?
Yes, exactly. Right.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, that's such a great thing. And I love the idea of that public-private partnership where you're seeing there's this thing, event going on, but you're taking advantage of that. You're saying, okay, you're going to go down to the deep. Do you mind if we tack on some science equipment? And I don't know, have you seen that change a lot? Has it changed a lot over the last couple of years or a few years, I would say? Are we getting more of that?
It's been growing. Right. And that was a big priority of mine at NOAA. And it was starting already in a good way, and I just supported it. Like, here's a neat example. It's called, I think, the Ocean Race now. It used to be known as the Volvo Ocean Race, and it was a kind of a world-ranging sailing race. And our bright researchers, NOAA's researchers at the Atlantic Oceanography and Meteorology Lab in Miami, formed a partnership with them to have them carry some of our buoys and deploy them into really remote parts of the globe where we could never have access ourselves, and therefore give us some data that we could use for our modeling and monitoring mission. And I mean, that was just, and they did that on their own dime, knowing they could benefit from our weather information, because that's what sailors do. And so it was just a brilliant win-win. And then we worked to expand those in every area of our mission.
Yeah, that's fantastic stuff. And we love to hear about that. And, you know, we also, though, if we can pivot a minute, love asking our guests about funny moments in their careers. And you spoke at the Our Oceans Conference in 2016, right after President Obama and Leonardo DiCaprio, which I just, how on earth do you manage to follow that?
That's exactly right. Well, so this was a big deal. In fact, leading up into it, you had talked about my kind of lack of aging, I guess. Well, so I'm sitting in a meeting with Secretary Kerry, who is now, and this is in the Obama administration. And now, you know, he's the senior climate advisor for President Biden. But anyways, we're in a meeting preparing for this conference on the oceans. You know, it was run by the State Department, and he was the Secretary of State. And it was a great event. All the countries who came made commitments to do work and then make investments to preserve our oceans. And as we prepared for what we were going to say, I'm in this meeting with Secretary Kerry, and everybody's given their all the departments, Department of Defense, Department of State, et cetera, are all giving their kind of spiel to him about what they plan to talk about. And he's, you know, concurring and saying it's all great. And he gets to me, and I talked about how the Navy contribution was going to be to help counter illegal fishing, which is a scourge across our oceans right now, especially from China. Mm-hmm. And it was then, and it is now. But he looked at me and paused after I stopped, and he said, "Tim, since when did the Navy start recruiting admirals right out of high school?" And I didn't know what to say to that. But right. Yeah, I looked a lot younger than the other people around the table, I'll say that. But that the funny part was, you know, after. So I'm in the big event. I'm kind of sitting on the side. And again, President Obama gets up and speaks. And then Secretary Kerry thanks him and introduces Leonardo DiCaprio. And he speaks, you know, because he has a foundation dedicated to the environment. And he reads his thing and walks off. And my assistant actually left me alone because she went to run and get his autograph. And I couldn't, because I went ahead. It was in my cue to step up on stage and follow him.
Right.
And so as I got up there, I kind of made a fictional story to sort of break the ice. And I said, "Well, it's great to be here, but I have to tell you, I'm a bit intimidated trying to follow the most recent Academy Award winning best actor." Because he had just won it for The Revenant.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yes, right. And so I'm up, and it was quiet. It's a huge audience here, hundreds of people. And I said, "Well, you know, because this is our oceans conference, and I and my wife is an oceanographer like me, and Titanic was her favorite movie, I figured I would ask her." And she, Karen, said to me, "Well, Tim, you might want to point out that the only difference between you and Leo is that none of your ships ever sank." And that got everybody, yeah. Everybody kind of laughed out loud and gave me a round of applause. And that was fun to do. But a cool story. I mean, it was great to be in that audience, and it was fun.
It's a good joke, too. I like it.
Thank you. Humor, you know, it's actually, humor is just such a magical grease in the gears when you're working in life, you know, and you can find ways to include it. I know when I was running NOAA, I always tried to make sure that we had sort of those light moments in meetings. Just things are always, there's always reason to be serious, but there's also reasons to not be too serious.
Right. Yeah. Couldn't say it better myself. That's great.
Yeah. Nick, you will try. He's a comedian.
Yeah, so
he tries
try.
To say things better than other people.
It takes, well, you know, I'm a little older than you, so, you know, just kind of have to cultivate that skill.
Right.
Keep it up.
Yeah. I'll try.
That again is a good pitch for the next question. So, you know, I'm super interested in all of your leadership initiatives and have looked at some of your documents and things that you have going. So tell us a little bit about that. What's the basis for the goals of that work that you're doing?
Hey, thanks, Laura. Well, sure. Like you in the role model way, which I think I want to learn more about. But when I was with NOAA, I had noticed how hungry people were, certainly junior people, to learn about leading and leadership. And I was constantly being asked about it. And because I had a career in the Navy and exercised quite a bit of leadership, and then, which the Navy promoted. I mean, the Navy is very serious about promoting leader development. And so I had that background. And I saw the need for it among junior supervisors who'd be thrown into new supervisor positions, having never had any leadership training, which is not really good. So you can just imagine the outcome sometimes. And so I took it on myself to kind of do what I did in the Navy. All commanding officers in the Navy will develop a leadership philosophy, and they'll promulgate it at their commands. And it's a good thing to do. And it's basically, here are my leadership principles, what I believe in. And when everyone knows what to expect, it fosters more trust and respect faster. And so I did the same thing at NOAA, and I put together a one-pager. And there's a lot of people who write books. I won't say leadership books are bad, but I'd say the number of really good ones are fewer, because I just think they're best when they're easy to remember and when they're from authentic experiences. And so in this like one-pager I have, it's that. It's easy to remember, and it's from all of my integrated experience. And you can kind of remember it because sort of the top line is all in, all good, and all for one. My three principles were all in is about being committed to your people and the mission. All good is about positivity. And I think that just is so critical in leadership. You don't want to follow the negative leaders or harmful ones or toxic ones. And then the all good is about teamwork and all the things that involve good teamwork, like diversity and inclusion and humility in leaders. And things like that. And so this one pager was pretty popular because people liked having something to learn from and easy to remember. And a lot of people ended up hanging it in their offices. And I was kind of humbled by that, but also glad. And like you, Laura, I'm writing a book on it now, because like this story with Leonardo and President Obama, I have a lot of great experiences that I think are worth sharing and might be able to do some good for people and help them learn a few good examples.
That's awesome. And you know, you have a reader right here. I'm ready for it. My favorite leadership book actually is also already a Navy book, if you might be able to guess what that is.
Wow. Well, there's several. You say a Navy book being by a Navy officer?
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, one that I think is easy. How about the Admiral McRaven? Have you read that book, Make Your Bed?
No, I'm going to write it down.
Yeah, there we go.
My favorite book so far is the Turn the Ship Around.
Oh, I know that. I know that book. Yeah.
I am terrible at remembering names, so I cannot remember the author's name. But
I know the commander, that's right.
I read it for the second time just last week.
Oh, good for you. Well, there's some great ones out there. Admiral McRaven is very famous. He's the 4-star Navy SEAL who commanded the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. Mm. But he was also the chancellor of the University of Texas at Austin. And I met with him there, and we have a lot of common friends from my time working with SEALs. And he's just a great leader that is one of my mentors and role models. He's kind of featured in the prologue of my book. And I'll send you the first half, which I've completed, if you're interested, because he gave me some guidance early on when I was with NOAA. And, you know, I wasn't uniformed anymore. It wasn't the Navy. And I wasn't sure really what to do. And he gave me some great advice that, if I were to sum it up, it was just do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And you know when you're doing the right thing and when you're not. And that was sure. That was helpful.
Yeah, I'm super excited to talk to you more about your book and read the stories that you have to tell, because you have done so many cool things. And I am already, like I said, a fan of leadership stories from the Navy. So yeah. I'm ready. Right. This is going to be good. So
it just means we have to have you back
on that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to do this anytime. In fact, maybe when I publish the book, I'll come back.
Absolutely. We'd love to have you. So, you know, it's funny though, because somehow with all of this that you're doing, you also still have time to host a podcast called American Blue Economy. And I think the concept of blue economy is really interesting, but many people may not know exactly what that is. So could you kind of walk through what is it and what can we learn from tuning into your podcast?
Thanks for asking, Nick. That's a great question. And one of our priorities when I was working with NOAA was advancing America's blue economy. And what that is and means is the sustainable, which is a key word, contributions of our oceans, coasts, and Great Lakes to our national economy. And by sustainable, what I mean is, you know, like does not harm the environment. And so sustainable fishing, for example, where fisheries are managed to not overfish and have fish be subject to overfishing, or any other kind of activity, marine transportation that isn't harmful to protected species like the North Atlantic right whale, and so on and so forth. So America has a powerful ocean-based economy and over 300 million and millions of jobs, actually, but ensuring that we can do it in a sustainable way. And that's what we promoted. And there's so many cool aspects of it. The five pillars we focused on were tourism and recreation, which happens to be the biggest one. And I love to go to the beach and aquaria and that kind of thing. And then there is also this ocean exploration area, the discovery and science, which is fueled by a really awesome blue tech industry. That's another one. I mentioned marine transportation, so shipping. It's big in the news right now with these bottlenecks like at the Port of Los Angeles.
Right.
There's also coastal resilience, ensuring our coastlines, our populations, our communities are resilient to things like sea level rise, to increasingly intense storms. And then, of course, fishing and seafood. And that's just a whole industry and culture that is worth preserving. And there's all an intricate balance among those. And now this podcast, what I do is I bring in people I've met, and I just talk about ways that blue economy can succeed, fuel our post-pandemic recovery, but also do so in a way that's positive and promotes cooperation rather than conflict, because that's a big aspect of our economic growth in the oceans right now is potential conflict, like fishermen and wind farms. That's not in a great way right now. And so what I want to do with the podcast is bring in people and figure out win-win solutions.
Yeah, which is excellent. And that's all the more, the perfect reason to have a podcast. So I do want you guys to check it out, American Blue Economy. And it's wherever you can listen to podcasts.
Yeah, it's on coastalnewstoday.com. And you look for the All Podcast. It's the American Shoreline Podcast Network. And just to make a little plug, I've had a lot of fun doing it. I've had on some celebrities, the founder of Pro Surfing, Ian Carnes. I've had a famous freediver named Megan Heaney Greer, who has also had her show on Discovery Channel. I had a USGS director, former director, Jim Riley, who also was a three-time shuttle mission command specialist and five-time spacewalk veteran, and the director of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, Peter Domenical, a good friend of mine, and on and on. I've had some fantastic guests, so be sure to check it out.
Yeah, it sounds great. We'll definitely have to.
Yeah, that's great. So everybody listening, go ahead and check that out.
But there's one guest, I had a special episode on one of my heroes, and that's the discoverer of the Titanic, Dr. Robert Ballard.
Oh, cool. So cool.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've known each other. And if you don't have the time or interest to listen to that one episode, the kind of long story short is this. So when I was a midshipman at the Naval Academy, a sophomore, I was in the audience when the entire student body heard him give a lecture less than a year after the Titanic, he discovered it. And I was just enthralled and seeing all the technology and what he did. And it was there and then that I committed to become a naval oceanographer. Wow. And it turns out, though, coming full circle, as the oceanographer of the Navy, he invited me to go on his new ship. He has a ship that does exploration called the Nautilus, just like Captain Nemo in the 20,000 Leagues. Yeah. He, that's his email has Captain Nemo, and it has been his like hero since a kid. But he was my hero. And then now I ended up sailing with him and diving on a shipwreck of a U.S. aircraft carrier off San Francisco. And then when I came to NOAA, no kidding, that ocean exploration program I talked about, we funded him through that to the tune of about $6 million. So the joke is, he may have been my hero when I was a midshipman, but by the time I reached NOAA, I was his $6 million man. But we're great friends. And the episode's terrific because we have so much in common and so many common friends and interests. So check that out.
Yeah. Well, we have to. Yeah, that's awesome. It does. It sounds awesome. And if you want people to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Sure. I have a website. And my daughter actually built it. She's a communications major at Nova Southeastern in Fort Lauderdale. And with a marine biology minor, I made sure she did that.
Of course.
And it's oceanstl.com.
Perfect.
Tim, this has been awesome. Is there anything else you would like to add that we didn't get to ask you?
No, I just want to thank you for what you're doing. I'm an environmental professional. I'm glad that you host a venue that brings together environmental professionals and educates them. So I think it's good work. I think the more Americans now care about our environment and finding ways that they can do something about it and learn more about it is important. And you're doing just that. So let me give you both, Nick and Laura, a round of applause virtually. And thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, Tim, for being in. We really appreciated having you on. And that's our show. Thank you, Tim, so much for joining us. It was really great talking with you and getting to know a little bit more about what you do and how you do it. Really, really incredible career. We're really thankful to have you on. As always, please be sure to check us out each and every Friday. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. See you, everybody.